Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Chet Haas on the Android DevRel team.
I'm Tor Norby from Android Studio.
I'm Romain Guy from the Android Toolkit team.
I'm Nick Butcher from the Android DevRel team.
I'm Clara Vallari from the Android Toolkit team.
And I'm Leland Richardson on the Compose team.
And I'm Adam Powell from the Compose and Android Toolkit teams.
I think the only person that didn't say Android was Leland. So apparently Leland is, he's probably on, I don't know, the web team or something.
I'm like on my own team.
I think this must be a new record for us too, in terms of number of participants.
It's getting there, certainly for a remote recording. So we're going to have all kinds of collision bounces the entire time. Probably nobody is going to be able to complete a sentence for the entire episode. It's going to be awesome.
You mean there's four people to interrupt chat at all times?
I was about to say, this sounds like a regular meeting to me.
We strive for more, and we don't actually make it, but we do strive. So today, given the cast of characters that we have on the show, why don't we talk about, I don't know, Jetpack Compose. So
again?
We're just going to keep beating that drum until it's beaten. We are talking about it today. We're recording before the Jetpack Compose event, and then there's going to be a Jetpack Compose event next week, I think, which is also simultaneous with beta. So I'm going to take that leap and say, you know what? A beta is out there now. So it's a good time to talk about Jetpack Compose and where things are at.
I can't wait for the episode to come out where you will have to voice over every time you say beta.
Yes.
And to have an alpha 14.
No. It's software. I'm sure that it'll ship on time. Absolutely.
We don't talk about future releases, Chet.
But this is future in the past. It's like one of those sci-fi things. We're caught in a time loop, I think. So why doesn't somebody who wants to give us sort of an overview of where we're at with Compose, like what does it mean to be at beta? Why do we declare beta now? Where's the feature set at? How about Clara?
So for beta, our main goal was to be feature complete and try and get as much API stability. We say API stability, we're going to try and keep 100%. We're also realistic. But yeah, we're trying to make a stable version so that we can move forward towards release, but still get feedback in. But now, if you're going to start trying to build things on top of us, we're not going to break you every 2 weeks, which is great.
And by feature complete, what Clara means is feature complete in terms of the feature set that we decided would be enough for apps to start adopting beta in production. Because I think we said that in presentations or in previous podcasts, but we have 15 years of features to catch up to, so they're not all going to be there on day one.
If we waited until we catch up on everything, we would never launch, yes.
But I do love the recursive nature of that. Like, we are feature complete for the features that we said we would be complete on when we reach beta. Beta is defined by the feature set. Like, it's just circuit. Let's get out of this argument. We're never going to end it. Adam?
Yeah, what we're trying to say is that what's there in beta is what you should expect to be there in 1.0.
Yes.
And it should be sufficient for building real-world applications. I assume that has to be somewhere in there for defining what those features are, Nick.
Yeah, we worked very hard to kind of pick that feature set that we wanted for it to call 1.0. And we kind of looked at the common things that apps need to do. And we prioritized our features based on that. So it's not just we kind of like picked the easiest things and started and kind of drew a circle around it. Like, we honestly think this is like, a great 1.0 release that we have everything you need to make most apps. Obviously, there's more we need to add and we'll keep on building on that. But, I feel really good about the 1.0 feature set.
The beta stage is interesting, right? Because we have spent a lot of time in API design discussions. So how do you feel about the APIs? Are you super happy with where we are, or do you think we're going to have regrets? Because I know it was kind of a race for a lot of folks on the team to like get their APIs in before we close down for beta.
I was really, really happy with a lot of the things and kind of the furious activity leading up to the last few weeks of the release here. It's kind of funny. Everybody kind of has their own mental to-do list of like the things that they want to get in, but that they consider to be like fairly low risk and that they can get it in at any time and it'll be just fine. And that was kind of like the starting point for everybody landing all of those sorts of things all at the same time right near the end of the release. So we saw a lot of activity between Alpha 11, Alpha 12, and then the branch cut. And it's really kind of incredible. I'm really happy with a lot of those changes.
I was also going to say, you're asking the wrong people. Well, we're never going to be happy with it, but feedback from outside says we're pretty good.
So I am curious if there's like a broader way to view, what we think of as feature complete in terms of like, this is the functionality that we originally wanted to have in the toolkit. So I know that like one of the driving things in the architecture at the beginning was we have to have a way for this new UI toolkit to integrate with existing content because we don't expect everybody to just reboot their entire UI for their app all at once, right? So that's obviously, you know, one of those feature areas. I know that animations are in there. Like, was there access to accessibility? Because you can't, you know, release applications without having some of that functionality. Like, is there a way to define it? Or is it just like, it's just most of what we need. And we'll get to the rest soon. You know, we've got containment. We've got a way to do lists of data. I've seen that in the demos.
I think one of the big things that we were trying to get is make sure that we establish the physics of the universe for building Compose apps. So we focused on a lot of low-level functionality that we can use to build some of our more foundational components and some of our design system components. And even though we may have left some features on the table for the 1.0 timeframe for this in some of those higher level components, we wanted to make sure that all of the primitives that you would use to build those yourself are all there because they're the same things that we're going to use later too.
There's also something interesting about Jetpack Compose. I mean, it's obvious, but it isn't at the same time. It's a library, it's unbundled. So we're not going to need to wait a year between new versions of the UI toolkit. So, and that's how we're at ease with not having this grand feature set that would match the past 15 years. It's because we know that we'll be able to deliver those features very quickly, even after 1.0. It's kind of up to us to decide how fast we want to deliver new features. But even if you need something, right away, because we do all the work in the open, you can always grab what you need, I suppose, and put it in your app.
There's actually like both ends of that two-way street. I'm gonna start a metaphor here that's not going to work at all. Where we can release when we need to get the bits out there, but also everybody can adopt this when they need to. They don't need to wait for that platform release. They don't need to wait for their users to get that platform release. If they are waiting for that, the feature that we just dropped in that dot release, they can pick it up, they can build against it, they can release their app accordingly. So yeah, it should be much more dynamic in terms of being able to build on that capability. I assume that really important components like spinner and analog clock, like these must be in the initial release. And then you're waiting for more complex things that are less
useful. You're joking, but we do have drop-down menus, which are what you know as a spinner.
Yes. As long as we made the name correct, I am cool with that. We need drop-downs. We don't need to call them spinners.
But now all developers ask us for mappings because they can't find their spinner.
Although we did consider an async task quite seriously for a while.
In kind of a very ha-ha but no really sort of way, it would have been one of those things that, the original name for Fragments was kind of an attempt to Google bomb ourselves at the time, like in 2010 there. And we're not above making those sorts of references still today.
So newbie question, since you mentioned async task, what is our asynchronous recommendation for Compose? Is it coroutines?
Coroutines.
Yeah, coroutines end up working really well with Compose, but it's not a requirement to use them. So, and also, Compose is a UI toolkit. It doesn't necessarily mandate a solution here, but we have APIs in Compose that make it easy to do coordinated asynchronous work kind of with your UI as you may need. And a lot of them are coroutine based, but there are also APIs that are not in case that doesn't work well for you.
Speaking of coroutines, there's one thing that's interesting in Compose that we do use coroutines in a few places. It's pretty big departure in terms of implementation compared to the existing toolkit. So is that something you can explain? I think we use them, in animations, inputs, other places. Why coroutines in those APIs that, worked just fine before?
The biggest thing is that it gives us scoping and cancellation control. One of the hardest things that we had to work with in the Vue system is this idea of when to remove pending callbacks, when to remove other pending asynchronous operations. We gave people advice for years and years that whenever you write a custom Vue, your on detached from window is full of just removing any other ongoing posted handler messages that might still be outstanding. One of the nice things about coroutines is that you don't have to do that. All that, it just kind of comes for free out of the box implicitly. So when a composable leaves the composition, then we can shut down any other pending ongoing work that it might have had going, and that makes things really easy to write.
And it's not like the old toolkit didn't already have multi-threading. I think text view, we discovered in the tools, we run some of the code to do layout preview, and yeah, text view goes and starts new threads. Because why not? I think it had to do with downloading dictionaries or whatever, but yeah.
TextView perhaps did a little bit more than it should have over the years.
Agreed.
Well, text is definitely an area where I expect Compose to be much, much nicer. And not necessarily for clients of the API, but for people who work on the API and implement it. Anybody who had to touch TextView probably has PTSD of some kind.
It's a bad day when you're spelunking in TextView.java. You know, it's gone wrong somewhere.
Yes.
The other thing I love about them, the coroutine support, is it gives us like a common language for combining async events. So, you know, if you need to, if you've ever had to like write a gesture which hands off to an animation, or you want to do, you know, a sequential set of animations, coroutines gives us the ability to express that in really nice kind of API ways. So I'm a huge fan of like how it does that. And it's one thing if one API has a suspending API, but the fact that we kind of converge on using suspending APIs in multiple systems, so in gestures, in scrolling, in animations, means that you can orchestrate and combine different async operations really, really in elegant ways. I love it.
I think also this is a good example of what Adam was saying earlier of building the foundations and focusing on cutting maybe top-level features in favor of beta having core stuff working well. We cut a bunch of scope in the last few months just to make sure we moved input and animations to suspending, just because we thought that was an infrastructure change that was worth landing before beta in favor of maybe developing more top-level components, which we can land much later.
Couldn't you add coroutine support in the background? Isn't that the whole point? If we can't, haven't they failed completely?
The big reason why we wanted that out of the gate was just to kind of establish that baseline that Nick was talking about. We wanted to make sure that anything that was sort of Compose native that people wrote in these domains of things like animation or input, gesture handling, things like that, was kind of intrinsically composable with one another. And I'm pretty happy with how a bunch of that came out. Like a lot of that started prototyping probably beginning of last summer. More of the IR backend compiler support for building suspend functions came online. We were able to start doing more and more of it in the real live code base. But yeah, the timelines were definitely a little tight on that.
So you touched on something interesting. You mentioned the new IR backend, which is it's not experimental anymore in 1.4.30, and it should be on by default in 1.5, I believe. So it's interesting, right? Because as the team was working on Compose, we were so using this new IR backend. But it had limitations. Like coroutines didn't work for a long time. Inlining didn't work at some point. So inline classes just didn't work at all. How did the team deal with that? Like, how did you keep in mind everything that you wanted to do at a later point, like coroutines?
It was a lot of pain and patience. I remember me and Chuck Jasky at one point were joking that it felt like we were building a house of cards on top of quicksand. It was really interesting. And I think that a lot of different parties had to be patient, because I think kind of building on what you said is like we had JetBrains kind of rewriting their entire compiler backend. And then on top of that, we had the Compose compiler team building this new runtime and compiler on top of this being rewritten backend. And then on top of that, we had the UI toolkit for Android being entirely rewritten. And one of the hardest things was understanding when something didn't work, what the actual root cause was, because there was no subsystem in the early days that you could actually be confident in. So when something went wrong, it was anywhere in the stack that the actual root cause could be. And so, you know, throughout that whole process, I think there was just a lot of empathy that I think people had to have to kind of understand, you know, that this was painful for sort of everyone involved. And over time, things started getting more and more robust. And you know, we got there, but it was definitely a challenging project to work on for that reason.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of when the JIT was being first brought online for Froyo and some other major runtime changes in Android too. A lot of the same sort of thing where like you train yourself through your career as a programmer. It's like, no, the compiler isn't broken. No, the runtime isn't broken. No, actually it can be. And that's a legitimate thing to explore.
So this beautiful anecdote from the very early days of Android where we were going through exactly what you're describing. One of our coworkers, I think he was Jeff, spent a lot of time like trying to figure out a bug in his code. And then finally, he opened the source file of weak hashmap because that's what he was using. And he discovered that the entire implementation was weak hashmap extends hashmap. And that's it, because someone just needed it to like get code to compile. And and so that was the source of the bug. Wasn't weak at all.
I remember that story having a lot of heated language involved.
Oh, yes. I just gave you the censored version. And so what parts of Compose are you like, you know, I assume like you all have different parts of Compose that you're excited about. Like, is there a particular API or feature or foundational concept that you think is going to be particularly great for our developers or even for ourselves?
One of the things that we have kind of squeezed into beta, but not completely, is this whole concept of basically concurrent compositions or multi-threading, basically, for Compose. It has an interesting history because of all that we're talking about. And early on in the days of Compose, we were by what we could do, because there were certain things in the compiler that weren't supported, such as coroutines, and also cross-inline functions didn't compile and things like that. And so in the early days of Compose, we actually architected the entire runtime, and like basically the design of Compose was done in such a way that composition could be done on a different thread from the sort of actual tree building that ends up happening, what we call the apply phase of Compose. And that like was sort of architected to do that, but we never really turned it on because for a while we couldn't. And by the time that we could, it was really difficult because there was a lot of code that sort of didn't assume this type of thing. But in Compose beta, we have some experimental APIs where people can start exploring this avenue of Compose, where the actual composition can happen in whatever sort of coroutine scope that you give it. And that opens the door for a lot of interesting kind of optimizations that we can do around parallel compositions and, you know, basically doing work before the frame needs it and all this stuff. And I think that long term, this is going to be a really interesting, like, kind of secret weapon of Compose.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that it kind of builds on a lot of work that Chris and some of the other folks on the UI Toolkit team have done over the years to try to really squeeze a lot of additional performance out of Recycler View. Recycler View kind of does this thing where it tries to estimate the amount of time available on the main thread between frames, and it kind of will use that to do some prefetching of various items. So it'll actually do the binding of your item views in advance of when it actually needs them before they would end up on screen. But because of a lot of the assumptions baked into the Android View system, we were never able to really move that off the main thread entirely. We kind of had to take advantage of like this estimation of how much time is available on the main thread in kind of these slack periods. But we're really excited to be able to make use of a little bit more full parallelism for those sorts of use cases with Compose.
Another thing that is exciting of what we've managed to build is the aha moments that we're seeing in some developers. And I think like when someone tries to use lazy column for the first time instead of a recycler view, and they're like, wait, this is like 10 lines of code. I think that is, to me, one of the biggest things we've achieved, is really, really getting to how simple it can be.
Yeah, I love that. It just kind of gets a lot of the raw view code out of your source file, and then suddenly all of the other things that maybe in a lot of existing code you never really had the full clarity of what the code was doing, suddenly those things really kind of come to the forefront, like the data flow of your code and kind of how data gets from the rest of your application business logic into state that is then rendered into views that then sort of forms the feedback loop with user input. And that's something where that data flow is much easier to see with Compose than it was with the view system. That code may have been split across many, many different source files across several different kind of architectural patterns before, whereas now it fits on a single screen, and suddenly you find the ability to reason about that, and it really kind of changes how you think about your code.
Nick, you and your team have been working on the samples, so like, you know, actual applications. So I'd love to hear your take on it and what parts of Compose you like, or, you know, what parts that you find are maybe difficult to learn at first, because it's a pretty big departure from current way to program applications, right? So there are things to learn.
Yeah, there's definitely a learning curve. I think the biggest one is the declarative mind shift, like getting your head like wrapped around what that means and how data flows through your application. And it's kind of jarring at first, I'd say, that it's a very different mental model. But once you get it and we get to one of these aha moments and it kind of clicks, you can't imagine going backward, really. When you realize that your UI is just going to update when the data underlying it changes, and I don't have to wire up, you know, all these callbacks and go and poke some state over there and try and get this thing to update, but don't forget to remove this thing from screen. Once you realize that just kind of like falls away with the pattern that you write your code. Like, you know, showing a dialogue can be as simple as like, if show dialogue on my state object, then, you know, add this dialogue to the tree, else, you know, it's omitted. Like, it's so much easier than what we used to have to do, where we used to have to manually manipulate views and poke at them. That's been fantastic, the data flow. I think another thing that's been so much easier is like, kind of the re-examination of some of our APIs, the fact that, you know, a lot of them evolved over time, but we've had to have a fresh take on them. Like, it's fair to say I'm a bit of a fan of the animation system. sorry, Chet, but it has kind of like evolved like kind of slowly and built on top of each other. And so getting a kind of a clean take on that and looking at some of the best practices and, you know, how that fits with the declarative paradigm is like truly refreshing. Like, you know, you can just animate something using, you know, something like the animate as state APIs, which make it really simple to just wrap a kind of an if, and then, you know, you get back a snapshot of the current animating state, and it's so easy to feed that into your UI. It makes it so easy to add delight in great animations and to your UI. And, you know, we've baked in some good practices, like we kind of use the physics-based system by default. So because there's some lovely properties like continuing velocity changes, if, you know, a new state comes in and we're like, you know, midway for an animation, it doesn't just abruptly stop or snap to a new state. It kind of gracefully updates towards a new target value. So I've been, you know, pleasantly surprised at how easy it's been to kind of like build in a lot of these things.
So to your point about the learning curve, so I was playing around with samples recently to sort of see where things are at. I hadn't taken a look at it for a while. And one of the great things that you and your team have done is all these samples in Code Labs and the tutorials and stuff like that. But I found myself wanting some sort of explanation for what was going on. So when I was looking at a Code Lab and I was entering in these modifier values, I wasn't sure what a modifier was, right? And there are these new concepts that we have in the API, at least new to me. What's the recommendation for people that, okay, you want to jump in now, and these are new concepts, what's the best way for them to learn that? I mean, obviously, writing code is a great way, but also you kind of want the mental model as well.
Hopefully we've got different resources for how you like to learn. Like, I always want to go straight to code, so I love samples. So I just want to kind of like trace the execution, play around with it, change it, add a feature. But for people who are visual learners who want to read docs, then big push for betas. We know we had to build out a much better document set. So if that's your preferred way of learning, then we've got a ton of docs we've published on developer.android.com. If you like videos, we've got some video content as well, which we'll walk you through. The code labs you mentioned, I think, are a nice middle path because they get you writing code, but they have a narrative. They have some text leading you through and telling you the why of it. They don't just say, add this modifier. They kind of introduce you. The Layouts Code Lab, for example, will tell you what the modifier system is. It'll tell you why, you know, they work the way they are and the benefits of the system, that, you know, it's understandable and you're in control of the order and so forth. And it'll kind of teach you it from first basics. So hopefully we've got different forms of resources to support the different way people like learning. But let us know if there's something you want to see from us, because, yeah, we love like creating these materials for you.
Yeah, I can't count the number of times that I've forwarded people to that Layouts Code Lab. People have found it really helpful. Like, the layout system in Compose in particular works significantly differently from the Android View layout system. And just kind of having that initial foundation in the mental model, I think, has been really helpful for people.
I think the code labs and the tutorials and documentation and everything that we've put on the developer site is like a really great first line of defense. But I think it's important not to forget the actual source code as a sort of source of learning material. Everything that we've built is open source. But in addition to that, it's a really great place to kind of find out how these tools are used. All of the material components are built on top of public API, which means that that's a really great kind of place to figure out, you know, okay, how are these widgets built and what sort of patterns and practices did they use and why? I mean, there's a lot of great comments, you know, kind of embedded in that source code that you'll end up finding. And yeah, I think that's one of the really awesome advantages that Android has over other platforms, is that all of this is open source.
I was going to say, we can still do better at documenting the why, but yeah, we built all of the material components with the idea of you being able to unbox them. So we don't expose all the knobs to customize absolutely everything, because it's so easy to just look at the internal implementation of each one of them and say, oh, it's just pulling these four pieces together and I want to do something different. And just making sure we provided the cleanest implementations we could. It is the same team who's built the material components that have built the input system and everything below it. So we've really tried to work across the board to make sure we were making it all work together in the best possible practice that we could show.
Yeah, and I think to me that's one of the places where Compose truly succeeds. And it's exactly the point, Clara and Leon, you're making. Like, once folks start looking at the innards of Compose, they will realize how simple some of the components are. And, you know, I always use the example of button because it's an obvious one, but you open it up, it's like there's a surface and a box, or there used to be a box. I'm not sure what the latest version is. But it's nice because with the view system, there was always, even for someone like me, who, like, you know, knows the system by heart, it was always impressive. Like, you open one of those files and you have like 3,000 lines of code and you're like, okay, this is a complicated widget. There's no way I can understand what it does, or I can customize it or rewrite it myself. With Compose, like, I never so far found any piece of code that seemed overly complicated or difficult to go through, because you go layer by layer. It's like, oh, it uses two composables, and you look at those, and themselves, they are simple. So you really learn like bit by bit. And I really hope that developers use that to their advantage and, you know, write the components they need. Like, I'm sure that our widgets at some point won't fit the needs of, you know, some of our developers. So they should feel free to like recreate them. That's what they're for.
To your example, like if we look at button.java, the existing toolkit, well, that has a bunch of code in it, but you know what? It subclasses text view. Remember that horribly complicated thing we were talking about before?
Button.java actually has almost no code in it.
Edit text, subclasses text view, but turns on all the features that are in text view. So all the editing is
so
actually...
So all the complexity is under the hood.
When we started Compose, I think Chet's biggest mantra that he was knocking on us was like, button cannot extend text view.
Yeah, I mean, it gets worse because then there's image button that extends image view, and it's like a completely different universe depending on what kind of button you want.
And we took that to the extreme, like you cannot extend text view because we only have functions.
Yeah, and it's funny that we're joking about this. These are some of the examples that we use as kind of the founding principles of why this sort of functional composition instead of class-based inheritance composition is so important, because you don't end up in these either or sort of conundrums that we've had that have produced these sort of problems that we're talking about. But yeah, I just wanted to mention in the vein of like what Roma was talking about with going in and seeing that it's easy and being able to implement your own components or composables. One of the biggest kind of subsystems that I hope people have this moment for is the layout system. We talk about how difficult building a custom view is, but building a custom layout, that's just like this whole other level. And in Compose, like I'm really, really happy with where we ended up in the layout, the APIs that you use to build your own custom layout. And I really think that we're going to see one, I think that we're going to see some novel layouts being built in user land. But I also hope that people see it as a tool that they can use for these like really bespoke kind of widgets or whatever, where they see it as a tool that they can easily go to do that one difficult spec'd kind of, you know, design that doesn't really easily fit into the round hole of like a row or a column or something like that.
Yeah, that's what Adam and I have been telling a lot of developers over the years, and we understand why they were not doing that. But sometimes, you know, I've seen people spend a week or two trying to shoehorn like generic layouts into what they want to do when they could have spent like, you know, 2 days just building a very, very ad hoc solution. And frankly, like, you know, even with the Vue system, to be fair to it, like when you do something very, very specific, it's actually not that difficult. But you don't understand that when you look at the documentation, when you look at examples, like, you know, the examples we have are very generic. And so it feels very heavy. And so I understand why very few people bother doing it.
And one of the things about the layout system that I really like too is that we just got the opportunity to fix so many things that we really were stuck with the API of the Vue layout system. Like when you request layout from a Vue to its parent, we really have no way to communicate to the parent why. And just because so much about layout params were just implemented as bare fields over the years, and we're kind of stuck with compatibility for that, it was very difficult to try to like piece together why, and that really left a lot of other sorts of optimizations on the table. Whereas some of the layout DSL that Leland was mentioning that we have in Compose, we're actually able to set up these different snapshot observe scopes in different parts of the blocks so that we can actually tell when things change and be able to perform very minimal sorts of updates on the layout. So you don't have to run any more composable functions again. You may not have to measure yourself or your parent again. We may just be able to tell, oh, well, I just need to replace this child in this particular way. That gives a lot of flexibility. I think that some developers who've been working with the alphas so far have been really impressed. They've done some things that have felt really expensive in one place and then realized that when they can move it to this part of the layout, things just kind of fly.
The whole topic of custom views and custom layouts is interesting because it seems to bring up a new philosophy, which is with the old toolkit, we kind of needed to provide all these complicated widgets because it was complicated for people to create them on their own, right? And then you get this like this API that is very particular to this thing that it does, you know, time, date, picker. Like, here's a complicated thing that you can use as is, or you can design an entirely other complicated thing on your own. Good luck. As opposed to, I assume the philosophy more is now we provide the building blocks. We will provide the really canonical things that everybody needs, but we do expect people to jump into custom views and custom layouts much more easily because it was designed with that in mind. And therefore, they're going to get more of what they need. And then the API doesn't get so cluttered and specific around these sort of niche things that maybe not everybody needs.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, we've been kind of under the philosophy of get out of the critical path of other people's features. So before, like, we used to take patches from other teams that needed to contribute something to RecyclerView because, say, RecyclerView didn't have some core piece of functionality that they needed to implement their particular UI. And they would get blocked on us, sometimes for weeks or even months at a time, as we were churning through our priority lists and our review queues for some of these things. And we really wanted to avoid that. Like, that's the sort of thing that, like, it doesn't work that well for anybody at that point. So we wanted to make sure that folks are able to go ahead and just write their own stuff based on the same primitives that we're using. And the idea of forking a common component isn't something where you're suddenly signing up for just mountains of maintenance burden, keeping in sync with upstream over time, or trying the idea that you have to upstream something in order for it to become useful to you.
It is worth noting as well, before everyone goes and writes everything custom layouts of all sorts, we have built a layer of APIs that we call foundation and kind of sit in the middle between finished components and the raw custom. And it's because we want to make sure we're providing at least the building blocks that you need to do certain gestures in a very natural way, to do accessibility right. So we want to make people aware that you don't have to go to the raw immediately. There are a lot of building blocks that we've provided in the API that you should be looking at that will help you get a bunch of stuff right out of the box.
Actually, I want to put something on the queue for later. We should talk about tools just because I feel bad for Tor that he's completely bored talking about all these library things. And we're just going to lose him entirely. So I want to come back to tools.
I enjoy code as well.
I can see you working in your IDE as we're talking here. But I did want to...
Yeah, he's been coding this whole time.
That is Tor. To Clara's point, like, and the stuff that you've been running in your team, one of the interesting things about this toolkit is the introduction of material at a more core level. And I wondered if you could talk about that. Like, right now we have, you know, the UI toolkit for Android, and we have the material design components that sort of sit over to the left somewhere. And they've gotten, you know, much more functional and much more easy to integrate into the application. But it is sort of a parallel universe, which we encourage you to take on, but people don't necessarily get because it's not, you know, there in the toolkit. So I wonder if you could talk about the sort of direction of working more directly with material.
We looked at it when we started Compose. We're like, well, we could just build the Android button and the Android everything and then material separate. And it seemed to just not make sense. Like, I think the Android framework has a button because historically it was there way before the material button existed. But now we had a chance to do material out of the box and make sure that your first approach to Compose before you go and write all your custom layouts and custom views is pretty and is following what we consider modern UX. So we did tackle building material from the ground up at the very beginning. And that's something that the Compose team themselves have been building. So as we said, it's perfectly integrated with every other layer, which is really important to us. But we also haven't built the entire set and we're still working with the material team now to fully provide those. At the same time, we've been putting a lot of emphasis into what does it take to build your own design system that is not material with Compose? And can we get those trade-offs right? And that's where the foundation layer really comes in handy. We've been trying to figure out, like, well, what would a developer on an app that has a very opinionated design system want to reuse without having to take our entire material componentry library? And hopefully we've made some trade-offs there, and we may need to continue iterating that as we see more and more examples of apps trying to do this.
Yeah, to build on that, I think that's really simplified the story for developers. Like, I'm excited about the people coming in who are writing their first Android app. They don't have to suddenly understand that there's whole other material design components library that they need to include. Even though we've made it easier with the, you know, Android Studio templates and so on, that to realize that this is our recommendation, it was kind of off to the side. And I think it's so much easier in Compose. There is no button that isn't a material button that we ship. We have these unopinionated layers below. So the foundation layer is like what we like to think of as a design system agnostic layer. So it gives you all the Lego bricks, all the building blocks that you need to assemble together to make your own kind of design system. And in fact, we have a sample that does that. So if you check out the Jet Snack sample on our GitHub repo, this is a kind of an example of how you can do that. And the best example for learning is probably actually looking at how we built material itself. So as Leland said, look at the source code. I mean, if you want to know how to build a design system, it's right there. Like, it's basically a way to kind of like, you know, set up a bunch of preferences for this is how my color system works, this is how my typography system works, and so on. And then a way for your component tree to kind of reference that and use that. But like we said, materials build completely with publication. APIs, so there's nothing to stop you from building your own analogy, which is exactly expresses what your designer wants. But basically, we didn't want you to have to go to your designers and say, no, we can't do that because, you know, that's not how Android widgets or the material widgets work. We want it to be easy enough to, you know, either fork our components or build your own design system. So you can kind of like get involved at the layer you want. You can either build on top of material or you can kind of replace material entirely if that's what you want and build your own system.
Just wanted to really emphasize what Nick just said. I think like being able to build your own design and make it your own library is fantastic. And I'm sure a lot of companies will take advantage of that. And I really hope that we're going to see a vibrant ecosystem of design systems or even sets of widgets for Compose.
Make sure you have a UX designer before you design a much better look.
Well, I don't know. You know, Tor, I miss the days of Swing, right? Like with all those crazy look and feels. Remember the napkin look and feel and... Like, I want some variety.
I was going to say, we've seen someone build the napkin look and feel already.
So I was thinking that the nice thing about building with material sort of from the get-go at this time is I think it was a good point in Material's history where I think the first version of Material that came out, let's call it V1, was very specific, like, we are giving the following guidance and things will work this way. And the intention with Material V2 was... to make it more of a foundational system that defines like how things should be, but it does not define the specific look and feel of those things. So it's more like a system that people should use and then brand and customize in their own directions. And so the stuff that you're building on for Compose, as I understand it, is basically more open-ended. We're not saying all apps should look like Material apps. What we're saying is all apps should look good, and this is a way to get there, right? This is a design system that people thought about that you can build on top of. At the same time, if you want to do something totally custom that is not this, we've also made that much easier.
Yeah, and it's been a really interesting exercise, like verifying that layering. Like, for example, in that Jetson example I gave you, like, you know, we defined a button style which uses a gradient, which isn't a thing that Material does, right? Material, you know, uses these solid color buttons, and that's great. And that's not part of the standard button API because, you know, we try and make it simple to use the Material out of the box. But it was so simple to remix that component to kind of fork the button implementation. And then instead of, you know, drawing a solid color, I use a, you know, a gradient brush instead in order to kind of paint my own thing. And just, it was kind of like 10 lines of code to write your own button, which remixed the layers below in order to achieve that same thing. So yeah, while you can very much customize material to your brand and style and typography and shapes and colors and all that great stuff, you can also deviate when you need to.
That sort of level of separation was one of the biggest benefits of this sort of alpha developer preview stage that Compose has had, where we've really been able to iterate on, you know, not just the names of things and shapes of things, but really the separation between things as well. And that sort of hard to define line between a foundational layer and a design system layer, that's something that, you know, isn't as easy to figure out as I think a lot of people think. And once you build something, you're like, oh, this is perfectly separated. As soon as someone comes up with some design that's unencumbered by any sort of other design system, you realize there are all these pieces that like you did not account for. And so it's really helped us to have this stage of API, you know, instability that we've been able to change things around.
One thing that changed just even in the past, 3 weeks, which was really, really big at that foundation layer, had to do with this sort of separation between what's foundational versus what's like kind of these concepts from material design leaking into some of the other layers. And it was that the indication APIs for being able to show like the hook that was used to draw things like the ripples for pressed states and things like that moved from being based on sort of the state of am I pressed, am I focused, etc., to being based on an event stream of like those press events coming in and where they're pressed and like the timeline of some of those things. And it was amazing how much that simplified a lot of the implementation of things like the material ripples. And that was one of the things that I found really exciting just over the course of development of Compose in general was you know that you got something right when something like that becomes that much easier, when the data flow becomes that much clearer. It was really cool.
I think to Leland's point, like I want to give a big shout out to Android X and to the unbundled approach that the toolkit team and other teams have been taking in the last few years, because I can't imagine being able to iterate on such a major API change in the platform in the same way, right? Like we would take best guesses and we would try to work with some internal teams, but basically we would come out with a baked API. We started having developer previews, but honestly, that is not enough time for people to have really important feedback that causes a reboot on an API, because there's just not time in the release schedule to do that within these annual releases. So the ability for us to actually go out with like a pre-alpha thing and say, here's a thing, you want to play with us and check it out and see how it integrates and give us good feedback. Because otherwise, like once we bake that into platform APIs, like it's too late. And then we just start building on it. And then we end up with things like buttons that, you know, subclass from different classes in the hierarchy.
And also just a real big shout out to all of the developers that helped us out with that. You know, it's one thing for us to throw something over the wall and say, here, this may change and we'd love your feedback. But there are a lot of really thoughtful engineers that have been playing around with Compose for over a year now and suffering, you know, big changes every 2 weeks. And it's a better toolkit because of those people.
Absolutely. Like major thanks to everybody out on Slack, out on Twitter.
I was just going to kind of say a great example of both that and the last point about the layering is, you know, we had this separation between foundation and material, and some people were building their own design systems on it. And they were giving us this feedback that it didn't feel quite right, that we hadn't quite got the layering right, that Ripples in particular felt like more of an Android thing than necessarily purely material. They didn't want to build a pure material. They had their own design system they want to build, but they did want to retain that Ripple layer. And so like the developers who took pain early days, we know with all the changing alpha builds, to try it and give us feedback, we listened to that and we kind of separated it out. So we built like an intermediate layer so you can actually use the Ripples without the full material layer. And it's just a great example of like getting the layering right by working with the community and listening to their needs and trying to build the right thing for them.
Speaking of layering, how do you feel about doing layout through code and custom logic on a per layout basis versus using something like a constraint system? So like constraint layout.
I think that there's a big kind of like, I don't know if it's like a right brain, left brain thing, or but it's kind of like a working style thing. And I think that a lot of the things about the Android view system in the past almost precluded doing a lot of very code-driven layout things. One of the things that I like about Compose is that I think that we are positioned to be able to offer whatever approach your brain works with for things like that and whatever you find productive on your team, Compose is able to support you in that.
I'd also add, like, we've been trying to cater for both of those kind of people, and we do have constraint layout support, which I know Tor is very aware of, and we're making sure that the tooling in Studio works with the Compose constraint layout support. So we're trying to cater for both people who are very code heavy and people who are very tool heavy.
I was just going to build a little bit on the constraint layout side of things. I don't know if the dichotomy is so clear as like, you know, code based versus tool based or something like that, because the constraint layout folks have really built actually a quite pleasing DSL, Kotlin based DSL for constraint layout for Compose, to the point where I was kind of amazed at how much I wanted to use it more than I thought I would with that DSL on top.
We hear from a lot of users who use constraint layout, but not the layout editor. They actually enjoy the XML typing because there's so many features built into constraint layout, you know, especially around animation now, but in other ways too. So this isn't to me a tools versus toolkit question, more about like the philosophy of how do you think about layout? Nick, what do we recommend?
I found the rows and columns approach to be the simplest thing to get started with. So I definitely would reach for that first.
But I mean, the rows and columns thing is exactly what we used to do with nested layouts, right? We would have linear layout that was horizontal and vertical, and we would just sort of, you know, nest them. And the difficulty was you can't sort of do baseline alignment across cousins that way. So I'm wondering, is this a sacrifice in terms of nice visuals?
You can generally achieve the layout you want with both systems. I haven't really found it too hard to kind of align the rows and columns stuff. The thing where I found constraint layout really shine the times is if you have some complex alignment that you need to do, so say some custom baseline alignment, then it could be great there. I found myself reaching for constraint layout when you would need to use heavily nested rows and columns, not for performance, but mostly for clarity of the code. I found constraint layout really can make it much clearer what the content you're working with and less of the kind of the boilerplate, you know, supporting structure code around it, then that can make for much more readable and more maintainable code. And especially with the DSL, which I really like, then I reach for constraint layout. But I found rows and columns to be like very simple, very easy, and definitely the first thing you should start with.
Yeah, one of the things that I really loved about the collaboration with the constraint layout team was that it really kind of showed just how much this idea of like alignment lines deserved a place sort of deeper in the system. And that's what ended up happening. Like Compose has some fairly robust support for being able to supply alignment lines for children kind of across the layout hierarchy. And Constraint Layout is, of course, able to leverage that in the Compose Constraint Layout implementation, but we're also able to use it in some other places too. Like in Vue's baseline was kind of like the one special case where we had this. But now that that's something that's been a little bit more generalized, it was something where the collaboration between teams and kind of approaches for this really kind of led to some really neat solutions.
So now that we finally got into a nice, rich tools area, I want to cut the conversation off.
Typical.
I should point out, like, I think we'll probably do some deep dives into particular areas of Compose now that we're out in beta and we can look deeper into things like, you know, the animation system and the layouts and the material stuff and tools, you know, maybe we can do that. But I think people have places to go right now. So why don't we cut it there? And I want to thank everybody for the conversation. We'll see you for a future one. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.